Hi, this is Dark Journalist. In this special episode, we'll be presenting a documentary on the intelligence connections of Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. Now, we'll go in-depth and explore how Oswald was set up to take the fall for the most notorious crime of the 20th century. Now, we'll also be speaking with Judith Vary Baker, who knew Oswald in the summer of 1963 in New Orleans. She has some shocking revelations that will shed new light on Oswald's true relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. Here we go. Agent Oswald, the CIA patsy.
I was born in New Orleans in 1939. For a short length of time during my childhood, I lived in Texas and in New York. Then I entered the United States Marine Corps in 1956. I spent 3 years in the United States Marine Corps, starting out as a private, working my way up through the ranks to the position of buck sergeant. And I served honorably, having been discharged. Then I went back to work in Texas and have recently arrived in New Orleans with my family, with my wife and my child.
I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
You know, sometimes history gets it wrong, and this is certainly true in the JFK assassination. The recent media circus around the 50th anniversary of this event proved that there are still powerful forces committed to keeping the truth on this subject hidden. These forces have desperately tried to put the genie back in the bottle, but they can't. Over 70% of Americans don't believe in the official story of events. They know the media had a hand in this deception. Seasoned researchers have brought forward compelling evidence that there was far more to this story than was revealed. But the corporate media would like to take us back to when the Warren Commission was the last word. A lone assassin, a magic bullet, and no questions asked. In this program, we're going to present real facts that show Lee Harvey Oswald was not the assassin of President Kennedy, and that he was, without a doubt, an intelligence asset for the CIA. We'll start by examining the key elements that were used to portray Oswald as the lone assassin by the Warren Commission. We're all aware that Oswald is supposed to have performed the shooting by using a Mannlicher Carcano rifle, but what has been suppressed is that there was a different rifle found at the scene by an alert sheriff's deputy named Roger Craig. Craig's compelling testimony begins here.
Boone was ahead of me by about 8 feet, and there was a stack of boxes just at the head of the stairwell going downstairs, and Boone looked over into it and said, "Here it is. Here's the rifle." So I immediately went over beside him and looked over, and there was a rifle, but we didn't touch it until Captain Fritz and Lieutenant Day from the ID department of the Dallas Police Department got there. Now, Captain Fritz was the chief of homicide. Lieutenant Day was from the Identification Bureau. They got there and took some pictures of the rifle. And then I believe Day pulled the rifle out and handed it to Captain Fritz, who held it up by the had a strap on it. He held it up by the strap and asked if anyone knew what kind of rifle it was. Well, by this time, Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman had joined us. And Weitzman was a gun buff. He had a sporting goods store at one time. He was very good with weapons. And he said, "It looks like a Mauser." And he walked over to Fritz, and Captain Fritz was holding the rifle up in the air, and I was standing next to Weitzman, who was standing next to Fritz, and we weren't any more than 6 or 8 inches from the rifle, and stamped right on the barrel of the rifle was 7.65 Mauser. And that's when Weitzman said it is a Mauser and pointed to the 7.65 Mauser stamp on the barrel.
Craig's shocking testimony about the rifle being a different model than Oswald's Mannlicher Carcano threatened to bring down the official version of events. He was soon fired from the police department on a pretext and found himself the target of a witness elimination program. Several attempts were made on his life, and he became disabled. Finally, in May 1975, he was found with a shotgun blast to his chest. The ruling was suicide. The single magic bullet theory was the life raft the Warren Commission clung to in order to accuse Oswald of being the lone assassin. This bullet, that supposedly caused 7 wounds and was still in pristine condition, has become a punchline in popular culture for describing something absurd. Yet without it, there is no case against Oswald as the sole shooter. Dr. Cyril Wecht, a respected forensic pathologist who's worked on such high-level cases as the O.J. Simpson trial, gives us his reasoning for coining the term the magic bullet.
The single bullet theory, which I described a long time ago as the magic bullet theory. Conley sitting directly in front of the president. The bullet is coming now, and it's going right from up, downward, from right to left, and from back to front. Comes out, exits the president's neck. Here's Conley. The bullet in midair stops, comes back about 18 inches, and hits John Conley behind the right armpit. Not the left armpit, not the left shoulder, behind the right armpit. It goes into his chest, pierces the lung, destroys 4 inches of the right fifth rib. And Conley is a big bone, 6'4" Texan, destroys 4 inches of the bone, exits from below the level of the nipple. When you look at the Zapruder film, you'll see John Conley holding the white Stetson hat like this. Here's the hat, right here, at this level. And at that point, he's been shot. And the bullet has emerged below the level of the nipple. The bullet comes out then, and moving downward, it swings upward and comes up and around, and hits in the back of his wrist, produces a comminuted fracture of the radius, one of the two large bones that come from the elbow to the wrist. Comminuted means a fragmented fracture, exits from the front of the right wrist, moves down into a left thigh, and the bullet that Tomlinson, the maintenance man, found at Parkland Hospital under the stretcher, which on the night of the autopsy was from President's back, which the next day was from the President's neck, 5 months later is from Conley's left thigh. You with me? I hope it hasn't been too long a day. You have to be mentally agile to keep up with this bullet.
Dr. Jeremy Gunn, the general counsel for the Assassination Record Review Board, shares Dr. Weck's view.
The bullet would have been completely deformed. The Commission Exhibit 399, the magic bullet, has almost no damage to it at all. So that, to me, is just not believable that Commission Exhibit 399 did all of that damage. Even if one bullet could have done it, it was not Commission Exhibit 399. And that's really the linchpin for what the Warren Commission was finding.
There's a strange twist to how this bullet was found in this archive clip.
The bullet was found here in this area. And not on that stretcher. That's the stretcher I took off the elevator.
The stretcher he took off the elevator was Connolly's, so Tomlinson found the bullet on a different stretcher not connected to the case. This led critics to claim the bullet was planted.
Was the bullet planted? This strange encounter by a Dallas reporter at Parkland Hospital may give us a clue.
Group of nurses and doctors standing around with a lot of concern, and Jack Ruby came up to me. He said something to the effect that, isn't this just terrible? And he looked as if he was extremely distressed. I shook hands with him, and it was very clear to me who I had talked to and who I had called by name and who had called me by name and who I had shaken hands with and everything. But when the Warren Commission report came out, they said that probably under the stress of everything that was going on, that I most likely was confused, and that I talked to Ruby at the police station several hours later. I was dismayed when I picked up my copy of the Warren Commission report and discovered what they had decided about my testimony. And Among other things, I immediately began to wonder, you know, who else they had talked to, who they chose not to believe, and why.
Victoria Adams worked in the Texas School Book Depository building. Her testimony about being on the stairs when Oswald was assumed to have been rushing down them posed a problem for the Warren Commission. Author Mary Ernest tells us her story.
The scenario is that in its 888-page report, her story was reduced to only two paragraphs. In a nutshell, what she did was, following the shots, the third shot, she and a co-worker who were on the fourth floor of the building, they were employees there, left that window and ran out through the rear office door and down the back stairs. It was a very innocent act. She didn't realize the significance of it. As soon as she brought up the fact that she had ran down the stairs seconds after the final shot, moments after the final shot, then they were all ears. That seemed to bother them. She said she couldn't understand why, but they continually asked her about those questions. When the Warren report was issued, it dismissed her, even though it didn't do any of the time tests that it had done on other people involving the escape of Oswald. It didn't even mention in the Warren report that the woman, another woman, had accompanied her down the stairs. Her name was Sandra Stiles.
And then they turned left onto Elm Street. And as it got just past the turn, we heard the three shots coming from we didn't know where. So we went down the stairs to the second floor, out the back door, and around the west side of the building, around to the front, where we encountered a motorcycle policeman who asked us where we came from. And we told him the fourth floor, and he said, go back the way you came. So we immediately went back up the stairs and back up to our office. Except for my co-worker, I didn't see or hear anyone else on the stairwell that day. I did not see Lee Harvey Oswald at all or hear any sounds to indicate that there was anyone else on the stairwell at the same time.
Officer Marion Baker rushed into the depository building and encountered Oswald only 90 seconds after the shooting in the second floor coffee room. He describes what happened here.
As we came out of the second, on the second floor, I saw through a doorway, a window in this doorway, a movement. So I went over and opened up the door, and this man was walking away from it. And the next room, I later found out, was a coffee room. I called to the man, and he turned around, and Mr. Truly was there beside me. I asked him if he knew this man or if he worked there. He said, yes, he does. He was calm, ordinary, you know. He didn't look excited or anything like that.
The so-called evidence the Warren Commission produced was never subjected to the legal standards of a murder trial. Instead, they relied on projecting the idea that Oswald was guilty in the court of public opinion. The best example of this was the so-called backyard photos that purported to show Oswald with the alleged murder weapon. Now, of course, we know just how easy it is to alter a photograph. Therefore, as evidence, it's of no value. Judge Jim Garrison weighed in on a key piece of evidence that suggests Oswald was not the shooter.
The paraffin test would show whether or not you fired a rifle. The results were available before the end of the day. They showed that Oswald had not fired a rifle. But the way that that was handled was it was announced to the world that the paraffin test showed that he had fired a rifle.
Chief, we understand you have the results of the paraffin test which were made to determine whether Oswald had fired a weapon. Can you tell us what those tests showed?
I understand that it was positive.
The fingerprints on the boxes added up to the fingerprints of a large number of policemen, one unidentified man, and no fingerprints of Lee Oswald.
The evidence in this case had a tendency to suddenly change when it was required that no loose ends be left hanging. For example, Dallas police initially reported that they'd found only two bullet shell casings and gave them to the FBI. When the Warren Commission used the same report in their findings, the number magically changed to three spent shells instead of two. A pattern we've seen before, getting the evidence to match the preordained conclusion, not using the real evidence to reach a real conclusion. When it came to fingerprints on the rifle, we can observe this pattern again. The rifle held no fingerprints of Lee Oswald, and this looked bad to investigators trying to link Oswald to the shooting. The rifle was sent to the FBI for further analysis, and still nothing. Then, after a few weeks, it was announced that a smudged palm print was discovered on the rifle, and suddenly it matched. Oswald's mortician shares some insight on this matter.
I had gotten to the funeral home with his body something in the neighborhood of 11 o'clock at night, and it is a several-hour procedure to prepare the remains. And after this time, someplace in the early morning, agents came. Now, I say agents because I'm not familiar at the moment with whether they were Secret Service or FBI or what they were. But agents did come, and when they did come, they fingerprinted. And the only reason that we knew they did, they were carrying a satchel and the equipment and asked us if they might have the preparation room to themselves. And after it was all over, we found ink on Lee Harvey's hands showing that they had fingerprinted him and palm printed him. We had to take that ink back off in order to prepare him for burial and to eliminate that ink.
Obviously, with no chain of evidence for the rifle and mysterious visits to Oswald's corpse, the palm print appears to be another false entry in the record and would not stand up to any normal legal standard. But we must ask ourselves, if the palm print was faked and a different rifle was found on the second floor and the magic bullet was just an absurd device to make Oswald look guilty, then what would have happened had he lived and gone to trial? Dr. Jeremy Gunn gives us his view.
I think that if Oswald had gone to trial, and the judge had properly applied the rules of evidence and a jury had made finding of facts based upon the law, Oswald would have been found not guilty because most of the evidence the Warren Commission used would not have been admissible in a trial against Lee Harvey Oswald.
One of the fascinating things about the official story is the number of people who promoted it that didn't actually believe it. Now, the question can be asked, why should we? President Johnson, who appointed the Warren Commission, is a good place to start.
I can't honestly say that I've ever been completely relieved of the fact that there might have been international connections.
You mean you still feel that there might have been?
Well, I have not completely discounted.
Well, that would seem to indicate that you don't have full confidence in the Warren Commission report.
No, I think the Warren Commission's study, and I think, first of all, is composed of the ablest, most judicious, bipartisan men in this country. Second, I think they had only one objective, and that was the truth. The third, I think they were competent and did the best they could. But I don't think they are, me or anyone else, is always absolutely sure of every thing that might have motivated Oswald or others that could have been wrong.
Johnson and Warren Commission member Richard Russell discussed how they both rejected the magic bullet theory shortly before the Warren Report was published.
The commission believed that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it.
I don't either.
Governor John Connally, who was wounded with President Kennedy, also rejects the magic bullet theory.
I know a little something about firearms and a little something about velocity of bullets and the speed of sound as compared to it. And I know when I hear a shot and I have time to turn and react and not only turn one direction but attempt to turn in another direction, before I feel the impact of anything, I know that bullet wasn't in transit that long. That's all there is to it. Nobody ever convinced me otherwise.
Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry, who handled the initial investigation, tells us why he doesn't believe the official version of events put forward by the Warren Commission.
But just in my mind, and by the direction of the blood and brain from the president from one of the shots, it would just seem that would have to be fired from the front rather than behind. I can't say that I could swear that I believe there was one man and one man alone. I think that there's a possibility there could have been another man.
Oswald's wife, Marina, whose pressured testimony was used to convict Oswald in the public eye, now believes he was innocent and was manipulated to take the fall.
Flip wasn't guilty of the crime that he was convicted. Well, he was convicted by only one committee. He never had the trial.
The Warren Commission pinned not only the murder of the president to Lee Oswald, but also the shooting of a police officer named Tippit. But what did Oswald have to say in answer to these severe charges?
I really don't know what the situation is about. Nobody has told me anything. It's something I'm accused of murdering a policeman. I know nothing more than that, and I do request for someone to come forward to give me a legal assistance.
Did you kill the president?
No, I have not been charged with that. In fact, nobody has said that to me yet. The first thing I heard about was when the newspaper reporters in the hall asked me that question.
You have been.
Nobody said what?
Sir?
You have been. Nobody said what? Okay.
What
are
you doing
right now?
Right now. Right now.
Even in the early investigations of researchers like Mark Lane, the subject of Oswald's relationship with the CIA kept coming up. His high security clearance, his proximity to covert operations, led New Orleans DA Jim Garrison to investigate his intelligence connections, and he found that there were many.
If you, the people of the United States, will learn the truth that the president was assassinated by men who were once connected with a Central Intelligence Agency, of course, this might reflect on the dignity of the CIA, but I happen to believe that our form of government is strong enough to survive the truth.
I am trying to tell you that there is no question as a result of our investigation that an element of the Central Intelligence Agency of our country killed John Kennedy, and that the present administration is concealing the facts. There is no question about it at all.
That is your opinion.
No, it is not. I know it, and if you will just wait, you will see that history will support this as fact.
If you just keep in mind who profited most from the assassination, and then ask yourself some questions. Who appointed the members of the Warren Commission? And who runs the CIA, which has concealed a tremendous amount of evidence?
Garrison was relentless in his pursuit of the intelligence connections to Oswald and the JFK assassination. With public interest surging in his investigation, he would charge Clay Shaw, a New Orleans businessman with ties to Central Intelligence, with conspiracy in the assassination. Garrison's case was covertly damaged by CIA operatives. From there, media interest turned into a steady effort to discredit him and portray his efforts as grandstanding. Years later, long out of the spotlight, Garrison would never waver from his core beliefs.
Lee Harvey Oswald killed no one at all. So the point is, it wasn't a question of being alone or with anybody. He had nothing to do with the assassination.
He was employed by the Central Intelligence Agency. And it was obviously drawn into a scapegoat situation and made to believe, ultimately, that he was penetrating the assassination. And then when the time came, they took the scapegoat, the man who thought he was working for the United States government, and killed him real quick. And then the machinery, disinformation machinery, started turning, and they started making a villain out of a man who genuinely was probably a hero.
Oswald's activities in the summer before the assassination were linked with his work for a shadowy figure who was formerly with the FBI named Guy Bannister, whose office at 544 Camp Street was a focal point of anti-communist activity.
It was an old antiquated building on the corner of Lafayette and Camp, right near Lafayette Square. And Bannister had his office there. I had been in it on occasion. And I went in there one time with Lee to view some arms that they had brought from an old blimp base.
He's certainly not pro-Castro. He's an ex-FBI agent from New York who is a violently anti-Castro and working to overthrow Castro. If Lee Harvey Oswald is connected to Bannister, then the pro-Castro activity seems to be a sham.
Yes, I saw them once in the Mancuso's restaurant on the ground floor of the infamous 544 Camp Street building. This is sometime during the summer of 1963. I went across the street to get a cup of coffee, and which I did, and there were Bannister and Oswald sitting together at a table chatting with each other.
Guy Bannister's office served as headquarters for something that we later found out was called Operation Mongoose. And they had amassed huge stockpiles of weapons and ammunition that were constantly being brought in and out of Guy Bannister's office.
I came across the fact that Oswald, a private in the Marines, had taken a Russian examination. And I knew the privates did not take Russian examinations unless they were connected with intelligence. So that caused me to be curious about 544 Camp, which was the address stamped on one circular that they gave out one time before, obviously, Bannister told them, Lee, no more addresses. It turned out that was a side address of Guy Bannister's private detective agency. Well, I went down there to look at it.
Well, this is the address which Lee Oswald gave for his first Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets. Now, this building, 544 Camp Street, is the building in which Guy Bannister had his office on the side. Guy Bannister, of course, is the most militant right-wing, extremely conservative anti-communist individual in the city of New Orleans. There is simply no question about the fact that the Riley Coffee Company was a nesting place for Lee Oswald. He was put here. This was his CIA assignment. In other words, as I pointed out before, his immediate superiors in Dallas and his immediate superiors in the CIA in New Orleans are involved in the assassination. Not might be, they are involved. And consequently, the impression was created on his part that he was following orders and he just had to stay at the Riley Coffee Company until the time came when he was to penetrate the right-wing operation here.
I used to be in the FBI. I knew people in naval intelligence, and they were either across the street, around the corner. The whole intelligence community was there, and right in the middle of it was Guy Bannister having Oswald sheet dipped as a communist. He was employed by the Central Intelligence Agency.
Colonel Fletcher Prouty served as Chief of Special Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and liaison for the military and CIA during JFK's presidency.
Now, in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, he was in a unit, a Marine unit, which was tied up with the U-2 program with CIA activities. His relief from active duty, as you'll recall, is something that happened in a few hours one day. Well, I don't think that was a normal change. I think that was another one of these sheep-dipping operations.
Prouty's suspicion was piqued when he was sent to New Zealand during the time of the assassination. While there, he came across an early report of the tragedy and something else. Detailed information about the alleged assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, hours before he was actually charged with the crime.
Very interestingly, it gave the whole biographical story of this young man, Lee Harvey Oswald. And, of course, we read every word of it, inside the thing, a whole bunch of it on the inside page, plus a picture of Oswald in a nice business suit, white shirt on, necktie on. Have you ever seen a picture of Oswald dressed like that? When I got back to the States, I kept looking through newspapers everywhere to find a picture of Oswald in a business suit, but that's what had been sent by radio photo somehow to the newspapers around the world before the police in Dallas had arraigned him. I took that paper home, and I, through my resources in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I made phone calls and checked things out. That information that appeared in that paper about Oswald's biography and everything, all of that part of it, had been written and sent before the police in Dallas had arraigned the man. How could a reporter be working on just some 24-year-old boy and have the story all ready to go if he didn't know from the police who they had charged with the crime? So ever since then, I've been building up more and more information to see these things that were manufactured as a cover story ever since that murder. And of course, the biggest cover story is the Warren Commission report.
Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin, former Green Beret, recalls how, during his training for special operations involving assassination, he was given unusual insights into the murder of JFK by his CIA instructors. Marvin describes here how Oswald's true role was revealed to the special operations recruits.
On the John F. Kennedy situation, that was brought to our attention as a classic example of the way to organize a complete program to eliminate a nation's leader while pointing the finger at a lone assassin. It involved also the cover-up of the assassination itself. We had considerable detail. They had a mock layout of the plaza in that area and showed where the shooters were and where the routes were to the hospital. I don't remember where those were now. They had quite a bit of movie film coverage, it seemed like, you know, thinking back to that time, and some still photos of the grassy knoll and places like that. They told us that Oswald was not involved in the shooting at all. He was the patsy. He was the one that was set up. We did, myself and a friend of mine, form a very distinct impression that the CIA was involved in Kennedy's assassination. During a coffee break, we overheard one of the CIA instructors say to the other, "Things really did go well in Daly Plaza, didn't it?" or something to that effect. And that just reinforced or really added to our suspicions. And we really felt before the end of the training was over that one of those instructors may have been involved himself in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Oswald always seemed to be handled by someone behind the scenes as he worked on high-security bases like at Tsugi in Japan, or in his apparent defection to the Soviet Union. Let's take a look at some of these handlers. We'll start with George de Morenschild, who JFK researcher Joan Mellon has just completed a new book on.
Well, George de Morenschild was actually born in Russia. His family left at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution and went to Poland, and eventually George de Morenschild came to the United States in 1938 by himself. By 1957, he was working for CIA in the International Cooperation Administration, which is something like what they call AID today. It was a CIA front. And along the way, CIA enlisted George de Morenschild to keep tabs, this is his word, keep tabs on Lee Harvey Oswald, who had returned from the Soviet Union and was living in Dallas and also in Fort Worth. And so de Morenschild took Oswald under his wing, took him to parties, introduced him to people, and really kept a watch on him. And it was very dangerous for de Morenschild to do this, as it turned out later, because what it meant after the assassination of President Kennedy, that CIA had knowledge of Oswald before the assassination, something that they have not admitted to this day.
As time went by, de Morenschild seemed to express some remorse for having helped the Warren Commission portray Oswald as the lone assassin.
I actually believe that he was a very sincere person, and with me, he was extremely sincere, because I treated him almost like a son of mine. You know, he could have been a son by his age, or as a soldier in my regiment.
This pattern continued, and de Morenschildt was starting to sound like he was exonerating Oswald more and more.
I remember talking to him and looking at the cover of Life magazine, which has the picture of President Kennedy, and he commented how handsome he was, how young, how attractive. Again, I think this appealed to him, and every time he spoke about President Kennedy, he spoke kindly of his effort to improve the racial relations in the United States. And from that point of view, he definitely had love and respect for President Kennedy.
As the 70s dawned and congressional investigations started new JFK murder probes, de Morenschildt started to complain to friends that he felt he was under surveillance. As fate would have it, he was old friends with then-CIA Director George H.W. Bush, a future president. He wrote Bush, telling him that he was being harassed by murky groups. Quote, "Maybe you'll be able to bring a solution into the hopeless situation I find myself in. My wife and I find ourselves surrounded by some vigilantes. Our phone bugged, and we are being followed everywhere. We are driven to insanity by this situation. Tried to write stupidly and unsuccessfully about Lee H. Oswald and must have angered a lot of people. Could you do something to remove this net around us? This will be my last request for help." Unquote. The circle of intrigue had tightened around de Morenschildt, and when the subpoena came for him to testify before Congress, he was found dead in his Florida home. David Atlee Phillips was the CIA's chief of all operations in the Western Hemisphere at the time of the assassination. Phillips cultivated anti-Castro groups and specialized in creating covert paramilitary units. One of these units was called Alpha 66. The leader of that unit, Antonio Vesiana, is on record saying that Phillips, using the pseudonym Maurice Bishop, was working with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Actually, Harvey Oswald in Dallas, a meeting of 10 or 15 minutes with Mr. Maurice Bishop in Dallas at that time.
And you feel certain that Oswald was working with or associated with American intelligence?
Well, at least he was associated with Maurice Bishop. And if Maurice Bishop was intelligence, he was working for the intelligence service in the United States, I don't doubt that he was working with him.
Though Vesiana was harassed and even shot for his testimony, he came out on the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination and gave this statement, quote, "Maurice Bishop, my CIA contact agent, was David Atlee Phillips. Phillips, or Bishop, was the man I saw with Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas in September 1963, unquote.
I had an affinity for Cuba. The Cuban people are marvelous. I'd seen what was going on there. And many of the participants in the Bay of Pigs were on that landing force because I had known them personally in Cuba.
Phillips died in 1988, but he left behind a strangely confessional, unpublished manuscript, a novel about a CIA officer who trained Oswald. I was one of the two case officers who handled Lee Harvey Oswald. After working to establish his Marxist bona fides, we gave him the mission of killing Fidel Castro in Cuba. I helped him when he came to Mexico City to obtain a visa and when he returned to Dallas to wait for it. I saw him twice there. We rehearsed it many times. In Havana, Oswald was to assassinate Castro with a sniper's rifle from the upper floor window of a building. One last Phillips confession was related by his nephew, musician Sean Phillips, to JFK researcher Gary Buell. In an email, Sean wrote how his father, Jim, pressed David Atlee as he was dying for the truth. Quote, Jim knew at this point that David was in some way seriously involved in this matter, and he and David argued rather vehemently. Finally, as David was dying of irreversible lung cancer, he called Jim, and there was apparently no reconciliation between them. As Jim asked David pointedly, "Were you in Dallas on that day?" David said, "Yes." And Jim hung up the phone, unquote. E. Howard Hunt was best known as one of the Watergate burglars and the scandal that brought down the Nixon presidency. He was also the CIA chief of covert action during JFK's presidency. Before he died, he shared information with his son, St. John Hunt, that the CIA had participated in the JFK assassination. He refers here to three agents' involvement: William Harvey, David Atlee Phillips, and Cord Meyer, plus a surprise mastermind of the entire operation.
Now that David Phillips apparently met with Oswald in Mexico City before the assassination, you've said that Bill Harvey may very well have recruited a French or Corsican gunman to shoot, and you've also said that Cord Meyer had a motive in that his wife was having an affair with John F. Kennedy.
I heard from Frank that LBJ had designated Cord Meyer Jr. to undertake a larger organization while keeping it totally secret. I think that LBJ settled on Meyer as an opportunist, parent like himself, a parent, and a man who had very little left to him in life ever since JFK had taken Cord's wife as one of his mistresses.
Now you have three CIA officials who had, let's say, the means, motive, and opportunity, or some connection to kill Kennedy.
That's true. I could just visualize Harvey and LBJ forming a kind of a thieves compact between them. There was nobody with the leverage that LBJ had. No competitor. He was the vice president, and if he wanted to get rid of the president, then he had ability to do so by corrupting different people in CIA. And he had to do it with the limitations of CIA, because there was no other group that honored, if I could use that term, honored the clandestine limitations the way CIA did. They could do something, turn their back on it, and move on to something else. It was not like a military. There was no accounting in that sense.
Creating a legend by utilizing lookalikes to build a character profile is an established intelligence method. In Oswald's case, shady CIA-related assets were involved in building a picture of him that would later be used to portray him as unstable or even as a fanatic. Too often there are reports of Oswald in two places at once. Even FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in 1960, 3 years before the assassination, wrote a memo that suggested someone may be using Oswald's identity. When the CIA sent pictures of Oswald visiting the Mexico City Cuban embassy, the figure was so different from the Oswald the world would all see just 2 months later that they had to retract the report and claim they were mistaken. Then they claimed the photos were destroyed, and finally that the cameras were broken on the day that Oswald visited both the Cuban and Soviet embassies. Former CIA Director Richard Helms claimed in a PBS interview to be baffled by all of the discrepancies.
It's my recollection that at the time of Oswald's presence in Mexico City, there was something wrong with some of the cameras that we were using. We were trying to fix it. But the fact remains that there are no photographs of Lee Harvey Oswald taken while he was in Mexico City at that time, and I can't explain 100% why not.
Although Helms claimed this to be the case, the CIA station chief in Mexico City, Wynne Scott, kept a diary that clearly stated they had photos of Oswald, or someone claiming to be him, at the embassy during his visit.
Persons watching these embassies photographed Oswald as he entered and left, and clocked the time spent on each visit.
That's fine for Wynne Scott to say, but he has no evidence to demonstrate it. And he couldn't produce the photograph, so what is he talking about?
Helms found himself in denial mode once again when Warren Commission counsel David Slauson came forward and said the CIA had played tapes for him of Oswald recorded at the Cuban embassy. The CIA's official position was that all the tapes had been destroyed.
Just in the normal course of business, that after the tapes had been transcribed and the material was put on paper, then the tapes were routinely erased and used again.
They said to us, it was Wynne Scott, that would you like to listen to the tapes of this particular one? I can't remember now whether it was a wiretap or a bug. So they played a little bit of it for us. Could be that the one that we were offered to the opportunity to listen to was the only one that hadn't been destroyed. Now, even that, just one not having been destroyed, would show that Mr. Helms' statement was incorrect.
The key question is this. If Oswald had been at these two embassies demanding an exit visa, then why would the CIA destroy the tapes and photos of his visit? Unless it was not Oswald, but a double who had visited these embassies, and had been sent by someone who was trying to incriminate Oswald as a communist 6 weeks before the assassination. In the mid-90s, former Director Helms continued his denial tour, but in one interview, he was caught off guard by local CBS reporter Richard Bernstein on the CIA's true role in the assassination. This is their encounter.
And I am simply saying this on television because I would like the American public to understand that the CIA was not involved in that assassination, regardless of what anybody says. I tell you, we checked up on it later, not only at the time, but then we checked out when the Warren Commission was sitting and so forth, be sure that nobody had been in Dallas on that particular day.
You did that in November of 1963?
Of course.
Why did you do that? Had anybody accused the CIA at the time? So who asked you to check where your own agents were?
We did that on our own.
Why?
Well, because I just thought it was a wise thing to do.
Why?
Under the circumstances, you would have thought that it would be a nice thing to know if we had had any people. It might have been very useful if we had people in Dallas on that particular time. They might have been able to contribute something to this. They might have been in the crowd watching the
Is that why you checked, or did you check because you thought maybe some of your guys might have been
involved? I did not think that anybody was involved. And don't try and make me say it.
Was there a feeling that there was reason to be scared of the fact that the President of the United States was that mad at the CIA?
Well, we were unhappy, but there's nothing we could do about it. What would you suggest that one do under the circumstances?
Well, you know what people have suggested you did under the circumstances.
What was that?
You had the President killed.
Well, that's ridiculous. Absolutely untrue. Emphatically.
Can you prove that?
How would you expect me to prove it?
Judith Vary Baker was a young advanced science student recruited out of high school by experts in cancer research to join their medical program in New Orleans. She discovered that her two superiors, renowned Dr. Elton Ochsner and his assistant, Dr. Mary Sherman, were involved in an anti-communist intelligence operation to develop a cancer weapon to use against foreign enemies. It was in this nexus of associations that she met Lee Harvey Oswald, who she says was working for the CIA. I caught up with Judy to ask her about her time in New Orleans in 1963 with Lee Oswald. Now, Judy, let's start from the point where you're in New Orleans and you realize what the program you've been recruited into is about.
Here I am in a secret project that's being sponsored by people who are connected with the CIA, and the objective is to kill Castro.
I understand why they recruited you into this program because of your cancer expertise. Why did they want Lee Oswald?
Lee Oswald is a wonderful associate for this because, first, nobody's going to consider him having anything to do with biological weapons. Second, he is really one of ours, but he can pose, and he will later that summer, as pro-Castro so that he can dirty himself up to like he looks like he's communist so he can go down there and safely take the biological weapon to Mexico City.
So he's working for the CIA.
Absolutely. Also for the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
For both of them.
Now, you were both placed at the Riley Coffee Company, and you helped Lee maintain the visage that he was there when most of the time he wasn't.
I'm clocking him out at 5 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 5, right on the nose, because I am the vice president's secretary, and I can just get right in line in there and get that sucker, you know, stamped, because I am an efficient person. So he's got all these precise clockouts. He's not there.
Right. So he's off working with Guy Bannister or posing as a Marxist. Now, you had a close relationship with him. Did he ever tell you how his intelligence work led him to New Orleans in 1963?
He wouldn't tell me a lot of things. But finally, he said he couldn't because it would be dangerous. So on the 27th of July, he tells me they're not letting me advance in the company. There's something the matter. And he's afraid they're going to end up using him, you know, killing him off. They'll use him somewhere because he's expendable.
Uh-huh.
Finally, he gave up and told me, and he started confiding me from then on.
Okay, you've mentioned the company. So that is the CIA you're referring to.
So he called it the company, the CIA. He was borrowed by the CIA from the ONI, and he went through rigorous training. And one of the people he worked with, in fact, had a nervous breakdown and couldn't take the pressure. They were training him against MK Ultra, against being able to be hypnotized and things like that, against being able to be brainwashed. And this one guy had a nervous breakdown. They shot him. They killed him because he was far deep in the program. They couldn't. They said it was a suicide, of course.
Now, Oswald seemed to be incredibly cool under pressure.
Well, that's why he had been trained. And he was incredibly cool. And he said, even he's on record as saying, I am, I've been trained to handle soft interrogations and hard ones. Yeah, but back up any of that, he could take it. So they could not break him. They have to kill him because eventually he's going to say something that he can't say he's CIA or anything like that because they would have executed all his contacts.
Now, you met and worked with David Ferry, who was a CIA contract pilot and also Oswald's instructor in the Civil Air Patrol when he was in his teens. Can you tell us about him?
He's an intelligent man. They loved him. They, a gifted pilot, linguist who could speak many different languages, intelligent, scientifically trained. And, of course, he's advertising himself in the directory as Dr. David Ferry, psychologist. He's works with Dr. Heath and others that are involved with the CIA. They were interested in David Ferry in New Orleans because he had a lot of friends in the French Quarter. And, that were involved with, they believed in Santeria, they believed in voodoo. And we're talking then about zombies. CIA was looking into all kinds of, any kind of chemical, mind-altering chemicals. I mean, a zombie is kind of interesting. What were the drugs that they used? David Ferry knew the people that were involved with things like that. So that's how he basically originally got involved.
Of course, all the pro-Warren Commission writers who said that Oswald did not know Ferry and could not have were proved wrong when the photo of them together in the Civil Air Patrol was found. Oswald entered the Civil Air Patrol in New Orleans at the age of 15. He was in David Ferry's unit. Ferry may have been the crucial link to how Oswald was recruited by intelligence groups. Of course, this is the same David Ferry who was associated with Guy Bannister and charged by Jim Garrison for conspiracy in the JFK assassination. Garrison showed clear links between Ferry, Bannister, and Oswald, but a strange thing happened on the way to trial. Ferry was found dead in his apartment. Oswald was first charged with shooting Officer Tippit after the assassination. Then suddenly, he was also charged with the murder of President Kennedy. His detention was unusual. No legal counsel, no records kept of his long interrogation. With his intelligence training, it dawned on him that he was being set up as the scapegoat of the century.
Fire that rifle. The dispatches you people have been given, but I emphatically deny these charges. Oswald is hustling.
Here comes a man again.
I don't know what this is all about. Sir, I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet Union. I'm just a Patsy.
Looking back, it's obvious that Oswald had to be eliminated for the plan to work. He knew too much and was in too deep. The man selected for the hit was mafia-connected, gun-running nightclub owner Jack Ruby. Ruby later claimed that hidden forces were behind the assassination of JFK.
The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives. The people had so much to gain and had such an ulterior motive for putting me in a position I'm in. We'll never let the true facts come of our voice to the world.
Now, these people are in very high positions, yeah?
Yes.
We can clearly see in the testimony of people like Judy Baker and in the exhaustive research by investigators that Lee Oswald was not the lone assassin as portrayed by the Warren Commission and the media. The evidence against him was hollow, and his innocence appears obvious. We can also see that Oswald was an intelligence asset of some kind, and that the CIA has done their best to cover up their relationship with him. And they've had help over the years. The major media companies have obstructed the truth in this case, and slandered those who have brought forward compelling facts. Let's remember that in 1979, the House Assassination Congressional Committee found a probable conspiracy in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, but the media never followed up on it. Now, after 50 years, we as Americans need to set the record straight. The whole world is watching and waiting. I'm Dark Journalist. Thank you for joining me, and I look forward to seeing you soon.